Acme Mayor and Precinct, I know all about that.
Yeah, along, you know, all along the highways, anybody that spoke any kind of German, well, you know, there was a lot of English-speaking people at that time, you know, and they just didn't want any, well, I guess they were called foreigners or so, and especially said right there, no Germans allowed. I remember that little packing house on the corner there, maybe. He had a sign up, no Germans allowed, and it was harder for a man where I could go out and do housework, you know, or babysit, you know, and things like that to earn a few dollars. In fact, my first job was right down here with Alrick, right by those tanks. That was my first job I ever had, looking after a family while the parents went across the line.
Were you born before 39 or after? After. Pardon? Yes. See. You have no idea. The Oliver at one time was, there seemed to be a general consensus of opinion that Oliver would be pure WASP. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. No, I don't want this to go on the record. No, but there was that kind of a feeling here. And they were going to keep the Germans out as late as the 60s. There was a feeling in Oliver that it had to be pure. Osuiz was always very ethnic-oriented, you know. Osuiz used to have folk festivals, and they would invite the Japanese who had been sent over from the coast to Greenwood, and they would have the Ukrainians and all the rest. Oliver was going to be pure.
Was that during the 30s, when the war started?
Even when we came here in 46. We are still very aware that Oliver would be pure, there would be no Jews, no Japanese, no Chinese, no Hindus. And sometime in the 60s, I sound like a battle axe. I'm not aware of how many things I've got into, you know, without intending to. We had a Japanese teacher come here. Yes, this is the 60s, and I was active in the Labor Council. And the Japanese teacher had arrangements made for her to stay in one of the motels in the acre lots. And the school board had made the arrangements. She didn't have a Japanese-sounding name. And the manager of the motel was not aware that she was Japanese, but when she came to the door and knocked and said, such and such an apartment has been reserved for me, he said, it is not available. I brought it up to the Labor Council. There was a big hoot and holler. If I were younger, I would never get a job in Oliver. But I was so angry. What the manager of the motel said was, I thought I was conforming to the popular concepts of the town. You know, there were editorials. There was an editorial in the Penticton Herald. It got to the Vancouver Province. The poor guy was embarrassed all over the place. But, yeah, sure. But still, that was the feeling. Mrs. Andreni tells me, and she's a very bright Hungarian woman, that she was very conscious of this undercurrent. You know, if you were not white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, you just simply didn't belong here.
That was one of my questions.
I was saved because my husband had a Scottish name. They didn't know where it came from.
Our name sounds French, you know.
Yeah.
Whenever I go somewhere, they always...
I've never felt that I was in any way discriminated against because of my background. But I did feel it during the war years. Because I had a German name, and the Scottish girl said, Alma, you're a very nice person, but isn't it too bad? You know, and I had two cousins that had to go to court because of their German name, and they were among the first called in. I became conscious of it during the war years. I've never been conscious of it in Oliver. But I am conscious of the fact that at one time, Oliver very much wanted to be white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and we didn't have a Jewish person here. We didn't have a Chinese person here until his name came and opened the restaurant. We still have discrimination about Hindus.
Mm-hmm. What year did the Chinese restaurant?
How long
you
ago?
You mean the Tux?
Yeah.
Didn't we have the dentist here before then?
No. Dr. Ng came here later.
Can I ask how?
But that has no effect on the trade union movement.
Well, but it does in the sense that I'm curious to know what the hiring policies were of the packing houses, and also whether there were divisions between workers based on ethnicity, like ethnic background. Like, what did that mean in terms of working?
Not in my case, nothing.
Uh-huh.
It didn't mean
Did they hire non-Anglo-Saxon?
They hired the cannery mainly depended on the Duke of Orbium coming over from the Kootenays. I don't think there was any discrimination there. The Duke of Orbs were very good workers. I don't think the packing house had any discrimination when I worked there.
No, not that I know of.
I once had to fill out a form at the cannery, and they wanted to know whether I was right-handed or left-handed, and I said I was ambidextrous, and they immediately offered me an office job, which paid less.
What about between workers, though?
Pardon?
What about between workers from different groups?
I don't.
How did people relate to the Duke of War women? Were they integrated or were they separate? Or?
No, they were not separate.
Mm-hmm.
I learned to sing Starnoshka with the Duke of Boards. I thought they were beautiful people. The dumper at the Oliver Co-op had a father who was part of Tolstoy's book, Resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew all about a great deal about politics. I don't think the Oliver Co-op in any way discriminated against nationalities.
No, I don't.
Not when we were working there.
No.
What
they might have in earlier years, but
what about
not
in terms of union consciousness. Like, were there differences amongst different ethnic groups, or like between the Duke of Orleans and?
No, they were solid union supporters. And they had the most to lose, you know.
In what
but
way?
Well, they could have lost their cabins, you know, where they were working at the Oliver Co-op.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way that they were going to cross the picket line. I think the other people that were most solid were the recent immigrants that had come from Europe. At the Haynes Co-op, there were only two people on the picket line, and one was Art Blanc, and the other was his sister, Mrs. Kuhn. Art Blanc's wife at that time was suspected of having a TB, and Mr. Kuhn had come over and had... They were cultivated people, you know, in Europe. He'd come over and he... Oh. Allie, could you get some more antipasto, please? They had the most to lose, but they were the only two people that went on the picket line in the Haines Co-op. I would not rate anyone on the basis of their background or their racial origin or anything else as to who went out and who didn't go out. Would you?
No, I wouldn't either.
No.
Okay, let's go back to the strike a bit. So the issues...
Four months from now.
Feelings after the strike. Okay. The issues were better wages, and you were going for 10 cents an hour.
Yeah.
And that's what basically took you out. There were some other issues that were like secondary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So can you describe the process of getting organized for that strike? Did you have union meetings? How did you decide to go for the 10 cents an hour increase?
We had a union meeting at which we decided. Well, actually, we had a convention at which it was decided 10 cents or bust was going to be the slogan. We also had a union meeting in Oliver. I think you will think that we are incredibly dumb. We had a union meeting at which we decided we would go on strike. We were told that it would last a very short time. By that time, the council delegate had got fed up with Bill Sands and decided he's gone now. I wish some of those people were here. That was Harold Carlson. Mm-hmm. Had decided that he was going to drop off of the executive council and I should be his replacement. And everyone agreed. You know, nobody wanted to do it anyway. So
they got a good person to do it anyway. So
so we had an executive council meeting, and we were talking about the strike. And the paid employee, who was Brian Cooney at that time, kept saying, we'll give the strike to the Oliver Suez area at the height of peaches, and it's only going to last 3 days.
Okay, so this was between the five companies that were organized into the agreement. How could they give you a strike? Like, what did that mean?
No, I would have to think about it. It wasn't just the Oliver local. It wasn't just the Suez mm-hmm. people. It went all the way from Vernon, Kelowna, Oyama, Naramata, Penticton, all the rest of it. There were about 28 packing houses involved. Okay. But they, at the convention, they had elected an executive council. And after I first got into it, then I was elected at the next convention. And the executive was the decision-making body. But the convention had decided we would tie ourselves to the slogan, 10 cents or bust. It was left up to the executive to decide when and where the strike would come off. We had the meeting in Kelowna and Brian Cooney said, it's got to come off at the height of peaches. And it's got to come off in Oliver Suez, you know, because peaches are the crucial crop down here, you know. Peaches won't keep. Alma Geddes was a stamper, and she talked a lot, and she was the one that was supposed to know exactly when we hit the height, you know, the peak period in peaches. Before I went up to that meeting, my brother-in-law talked to me, and at that point, he was running an orchard down towards Suez, And he said to me, I don't know where I stand on this whole thing. I'm an IWA member. I'm with you as a union member. But I'm against you as a grower, because I'm growing peaches. And what are you going to do at the meeting on Sunday? And I didn't know what we were going to do at the meeting on Sunday. And he said, are you going to have strike pay? And I didn't know whether we were going to have strike pay. And he said, okay, I want to give you a little bit of advice. I still don't know whether I'm going to be with you or against you. But I want to give you some advice. He said, I think, I told him that the general consensus of opinion was that the strike would only last 3 days. And he felt that he wouldn't bet on it. And he said, if I were you, I would make sure that they get at least the equivalent of unemployment insurance, a strike pay. Because he said the first time somebody's 50 cents short of going to the grocery store, they will start thinking about crossing the picket line. And he said, I think you should insist on at least the equivalent of unemployment insurance. So anyway, we went to the meeting. I brought this bright idea up. Brian Cooney was absolutely sure that this, you know, a lot of nonsense. What are we worrying about? The strike is going to be over in 3 days. They can't pack the peaches, and they got to pack the peaches. And the whole thing was turned down. And I was really very upset. And then Clarence Holmes, who was originally going to be one of our plaintiffs in the court case and who copped out because he got fed up with the whole thing, said, I think we should give some regard to the sister from the South who seemed so very concerned about the strike pay. Well, we're under Robert's Rules of Order. You know, and a motion to reconsider has to be posted and all the rest of it, and they had a great deal of kerfuffle how to get this back on the floor again. But they did manage to get it back on the floor, and it was agreed that we would pay 25 cents an hour strike pay. I wish I'd kept those minutes. Mm-hmm. I really do. you know, but that was the basis. And that is what happened, isn't it? Right. We kept tab. I mean,
was that for picket duty that you paid strike?
Yeah, we paid for picket duty. We didn't pay the people that stayed at home. Mm-hmm. Lydia was one of the ones that I can think of all kinds of people that honored the strike but never showed their face. You know, and I still honor them, too.
So you had this basic decision to go on strike.
Yeah.
You knew what area you were going to hit. What was the process of actually mobilizing for the strike? Were most workers in the industry convinced that they needed to strike? Or was there divisions around it? Were there questions?
Yes, there were questions. And I'm sorry that one of the women that really questioned it isn't here today. She's over in the Kootenays, and her name is Lily Trivick. She was hoping to go back to Ireland. She'd been in Canada for some time, and she was madly earning money to go back to Ireland. She loudly protested about the strike. She voted against it. She was very vociferous. And when the strike came off, she went out in the picket line and watched her co-workers who had voted for the strike and all the rest of it cross the picket line. So she would have another story to tell you.
So she changed her mind?
She had worked at Roundtree's.
Yeah.
In Dublin. And she knew something about slave labor. And she had a very strong feeling for the trade union movement. But she was absolutely opposed to the strike. Okay,
one of the things.
Okay, I just want to tell you, 27 years later, it's hard to realize how dumb we were. I didn't know exactly how. My brother-in-law had some experience in the IWA. My brothers had some experience about being on strike. But I really didn't know how you went about. But I've seen pictures of people carrying sandwich boards. And so we rented the Odd Fellows lower hall, and I bought a whole bunch of cardboard, and I got some black felt pens, and I made a lot of these signs, "Our men work for $1.05 an hour," and we got some string and tied them together. I wrote a letter to Charlie Hamilton, who was the labor relations officer in Kelowna, and said, you know, what do you do when you're on a picket line, and what is the procedure, and please tell me. I didn't know that he was not the person that I should have written to. However, good old Charlie went and took the letter to Brian Cooney, and Brian Cooney, who was the business agent and hadn't bothered to tell us anything about how you act on a strike, blew his stack and was furious and phoned down and told me.
That's what I was wondering, is what role did the union, the central union, play in giving you support?
Brian Cooney was so convinced the strike would only last 3 days that he didn't have to be concerned. And the IWA, we belonged to the TLC at that time. There were two major labor bodies in Canada. There was the Canadian Congress of Labor, and there was the Trades and Labor Congress. Trades and Labor, what was it? Yeah. IWA offered to help support us, but because they belonged to the other labor congress, Brian Cooney told them to buzz off. We didn't need their help. So anyway, I wrote to Charlie Hamilton. Charlie Hamilton took a letter to Brian Cooney, and Brian Cooney blew a stack. And then the Oliver Group rented the Odd Fellows Hall, and we went down and we made all these silly posters, and we all agreed that we'd be there at 7 o'clock in the morning, all carrying our posters.
Yay.
Yay, yay.
How much were you making at that time?
I think we were making around 75 cents. I don't really remember.
So your slogan, "Our husbands, our men are making $1.05 an hour,"
yeah,
is an example of,
yeah,
how low your wages.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have any pointing at your wages?
Pardon?
Do you have any pointing at what your wages were?
No, no. We felt that the public would be shocked if they saw that the men were only making $1.05 an hour. Well, anyway, our men cheerfully walked to the picket lines after the strike was over. One of them said to me, "You came in too soon. You should have stuck it out." We settled for 5 cents an hour.
Right. So no. I'm just trying to get back to sort of consecutive,
yeah,
order. So you guys...
So at 7 o'clock in the Monday morning, well, no, on the Friday, management was stringing up a PA system in the packing house. Friday or Saturday, I don't even remember the year, but remember they were climbing all over the rafters and stringing up that PA system, and the PA system didn't work, and then we were called to the end of the grader and told to report to the ladies' room, the ladies' lunchroom, and we were going to have a talk. And it was on company time, so everybody went up to the ladies' lunchroom to listen to this little talk. And it's a fair-sized room, and we're all standing around, and then the manager gives us this tremendous pep talk, and he talks about loyalty and how the packing house has to keep operating, and you know, what's going to happen to the fruit and what's going to happen to the farmers. And I looked at the president of our union, who at that time was Milton Hallman. You can give me another drink. I'm going to need it. I looked at Milton Hallman, who was the president of the union, and he sort of looked away, and I looked at John Sousoff, who was the chief shop steward, and we used to have regular monthly meetings 1 week ahead of the union meeting that involved all five packing houses. We had shop stewards from every packing house, and we'd bring all our complaints there. He looked away, and I looked around, and it appeared that nobody was going to say anything. And we'd done a lot of talking in the lunchroom, and I looked at people like Mrs. Foster, you know, who basically didn't know should she or shouldn't she, and there was Mrs. Guidi, the elementary school principal's wife. There was the bus driver's wife. And I looked at all these undecided faces, and I thought, somebody's got to say something, you know, or else they'll all come in on Monday. And who's going to say it? Well, it appeared that Milton wasn't going to say anything. It appeared that Johnny Sousoff wasn't going to say anything. And so when you're desperate enough, you say something, you know. And I started out with a very faltering voice. Mr. Morgan, and Mr. Morgan's wife was one of my best friends. You know, it made it really very tough in a small town when there is a friendship relationship based on church and our ideas. And they'd been to our place for supper, I'd been to their place for supper. Suddenly we're in a very formal situation, and I started out stammering and stuttering. Mr. Morgan, you've talked a great deal about loyalty. I want to tell you we're very loyal. We're also very desperate. We're going to be out on strike. We've tried everything, you know, and I go through... I think in my dreams, I must have rehearsed this whole damn speech. I go through the whole thing. What happened at our appearances in front of the arbitration board? What happened in the... bias news releases, and that Mr. L.R. Stevens, who is your representative, recently said in a news report that he would venture to say that when we argued that a lot of the fruit is sold on roadside stands, he said he would venture to say that there were not more than 3 dozen roadside stands in all of the Okanagan and the Kootenays. And then by this time I'm yelling, you know, I've lost my head anyway, so what the hell? I'm yelling, and I said, and the other night my husband and I went on a car ride to Asuyas, and we counted 44 open roadside stands between Oliver and Asuyas, a distance of 13 miles. One was closed. And I'm going on. I don't really remember all the things I said, but I remember ending up saying, "But Mr. Morgan, we want you to know we're loyal, but at 8 o'clock on Monday morning, we're going to be on the picket line." And with that, I walked out the door, and I'm bawling. I'm going down the stairs. Gee. And two men are following me, and I can hear one say to the other one, "Watch her. We're going to need her." But I just don't want to see anyone see me bawling. And I rushed down, and we had very elaborate washroom facilities at the co-op upstairs, but nobody ever hardly used them. And we had two little measly toilets for the women downstairs, and a place for the men, and there was a wash basin in between. So I'm rushing for the wash basin. I've got to wash my face. I can't let the world see that I'm bawling. And that was it. You know, and with that, we walked out of the packing house. Now, in 74, his wife, who now, Miss Morgan, Charlie Morgan, died a long time ago. He died in 62. In 74, Flo Morgan was back here, and we're sitting on the front lawn in the moonlight reminiscing. And she said, Alma, I think I should tell you that Charlie came home from that meeting. Well, Charlie put up his hands like this, like the priest saying a benediction. Okay, Alma.
Stop already. Yeah.
Don't yell anymore, please. But anyway, she said, Charlie came home, and he said, you know, he told her, it's really very unfair. And he said the growers could afford to give those people a raise, and they should, you know, but he didn't say so. But then that same packing house was the one that went against the Federated Shippers. You know, finally decided that if it had been left to them, they could have handled it better.
Okay, can you just